Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. Online and on KBIA, I'm Ruben Stern. For much of our history, scientists have sort of steered away from the study of spirituality. However, recent advances in brain imaging have led researchers to look into the brain's activity as it relates to religious experience. This emerging field, sometimes referred to as neurotheology, raises some interesting questions. For example, are we humans physically predisposed to be religious? Are there neurological underpinnings of spiritual experiences? And could the way we experience religion simply be a matter of brain chemistry? Our guest today will help us better understand this intersection between the brain and religion. First with us is Brick Johnstone. He's a professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri. His research includes how different regions of the brain relate to spiritual experiences. Welcome to the program, Brick Johnstone.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also with us is a collaborator of Brick Johnstone's, Daniel Cohen. He's a teaching assistant professor in the MU Department of Religious Studies. In addition to collaborating with Brick Johnstone on some research, he also has studied the impact of religion on mental and physical health. Welcome to the program, Daniel Cohen.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We also have with us in the studio today John Baker. He is the executive director of the Community Foundation of Central Missouri. Until last year, he served as the senior pastor of First Baptist Church in Columbia. Welcome to the program, John Baker.
My pleasure. Glad to be here with you.
Glad to have you with us as well. We also have a guest joining us by phone, and that is Andrew Newberg. He is a neuroscientist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and Medical College in Philadelphia. He's considered a pioneer in this emerging field and literally wrote the book on it. His book is called Principles of Neurotheology. Thanks for joining us today, Andrew Newberg.
Thanks for having me on your program.
And Thank you for joining us by phone. Unfortunately, we couldn't fly you in for this.
Next time, perhaps.
We hope to hear from our audience members as well. For those of you in the audience, what do you think of efforts to scientifically explain some of the human experience around religion? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I'd like to start with this question for you, Andrew Newberg. In doing this research connecting brain activity and religion, what are you hoping to find out?
Well, I think the main things that we're trying to find out are how our brain and ultimately our body connects to something spiritual for ourselves. What is the relationship there? There's a lot of evidence that points to an impact of religious and spiritual practices and experiences on our emotions, on our overall mental health and well-being. And I think if we begin to try to understand the physiological basis of that, how that actually seems to have an impact on our brain, on our body, that'll give us a lot better information about how this intersection between our spiritual selves and our biological selves actually works. And ultimately, I hope not only does it have implications for our overall health and well-being, but maybe actually be able to contribute to some of the more philosophical and theological questions as well. So I think it's very multifaceted what we can actually learn from this kind of research.
Mm-hmm. And Brick Johnstone, how does that fit with the work that you've been doing?
It fits very well. A difference that we have from Dr. Newberg's research is that when we got started, we worked primarily with people with brain injuries. And our interest was just to see if different parts of the brain were related to spiritual experiences. And we found some results that we didn't really expect. We did a bunch of literature research review, including several of Dr. Newberg's articles, and we started to put together an idea that spirituality is something that's maybe genetically inherited to an extent, which means that it's probably neurologically hardwired, which means that certain parts of the brain may be related to different spiritual experiences, and then that spirituality will be expressed differently depending on what part of the brain is involved. And then it's where my collaborations with Dr. Cohen come in. culture and religious experience pretty much will impact how those spiritual experiences are interpreted.
So let's talk about that. How does that all fit together then? How does culture fit with a biological wiring? I mean, this seems fairly complicated on something that is non-scientific to most people.
Yeah, it is extremely complicated, and I think that's sort of the $24 million question is, how does culture wire the brain? And that's something I think the research in that area is just really starting to get underway right now. There's a lot to do. But certainly cultural differences have a lot to do with how we perceive the world, how our belief structures work, how our cultural values work.
Now, you mentioned this is fairly emerging in terms of the science. Where did this all come from? How is it that this is now an area of scientific study?
Dr. Neuberg might be able to answer that better.
Well, I think to some degree part of the answer is that we just really haven't had the ability to even look at these questions or to measure what was going on in the brain up until the last maybe 15 years or so with the advent of a lot of functional brain imaging techniques. We just weren't able to do it. So I think that in terms of the emergence of many new studies that are out that are beginning to look at the relationship between spirituality and the brain, religious experience in the brain, we now have the capability to begin to look at that in a much more robust way, a much more detailed way than ever before, and I think that that's been an important springboard for this kind of research. I will add, though, vis-a-vis your last comments about culture, which I think are also extremely important. And some of the early investigators, in fact, one of my colleagues, Jean DeQuilly, was an anthropologist and was very interested in the relationship between culture and particularly rituals that arise in different cultures, how that had an impact on the brain's function and ultimately religious and spiritual phenomena. So I completely agree. I mean, it ties in beautifully to the overall richness and diversity and how all of these things come together, both in our mind as well as and brain, as well as in our cultures. So there's so much for us to still learn, and it's very exciting to see this field really starting to take off.
Now, John Baker, what do you think of scientists getting involved in this? I mean, you're somebody who led a congregation here in Columbia for many years.
I kind of see myself as a bit of a phenomenologist because I know a bit about what you're talking about, and then I observe it in the congregations and see how it either makes sense or doesn't make sense. Traveled the world in some places looking at the way religion is expressed in other cultures, so there's a definite cultural aspect to that, what is moving, what is meaningful, how people develop or achieve ecstasy in worship and how they don't, and how that changes from place to place. There are definite pieces of the brain that have to be being pulled in, either because they are hardwired or because they are developed over time or because they are imprinted with cultural patterns. Has to be that way to me. Makes perfect sense.
Now, how does this research work exactly? I mean, how do you figure out what's going on in somebody's brain while they're having a spiritual experience? Dr. Neuberg, maybe that's a question for you.
Yeah, thank you. With the advent of functional brain imaging studies, magnetic resonance imaging or MRI, positron emission tomography, PET imaging, these are all different ways of capturing what the brain is doing at particular moments in time. And it's really ushered in a whole field of cognitive neuroscience that never existed before, where people can evaluate all different aspects of language and emotions and so forth. And what we started to do a number of years ago and continue to do is to literally put people into scanners or to inject different radioactive tracers into them while they are engaged in practices like meditation, prayer. We've studied people speaking in tongues. We've studied a variety of other interesting trance-like states and ritual-like states. And you can actually see the changes that are going on in the brain. You can actually see more activity, more blood flow, for example, or more metabolism going on in the brain in certain areas, and sometimes less activity. And it really paints for us a whole pattern of responses that are going on in the brain. And to take up on what everybody's been saying, there are many different parts of the brain that become involved in these practices because they are so rich and diverse. So when people have emotional experiences, then we seem to see changes in the emotional areas of the brain. When people have a cognitive experience of God or of ultimate reality, then we see changes going on in the cognitive areas of the brain. So we're really starting to see how all these different areas of the brain tie into these experiences that people refer to as religious or spiritual. which to me is actually still one of the fundamental questions, is why does somebody call a particular experience a religious or spiritual one? And I think to some degree it goes to the phenomenological side of trying to understand what the person is actually experiencing. But it's also interesting to me to try to see how that ultimately relates to something that's going on in the brain, and that's where we're now, you know, trying to keep going with this, which is to try to really capture these moments as closely as we can, as carefully as we can, to say something about what they are and how they affect us.
Okay, I want to keep going with that, but before we do, I want to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about brain activity as it relates to religion and religious activity. Joining me in the studio are Brick Johnston, a professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Daniel Cohen, a teaching assistant professor at the MU Department of Religious Studies, and John Baker, former senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Columbia. Also joining us by phone is Andrew Newberg, a neuroscientist and author of the book Principles of Neurotheology. For those of you in our audience, what do you think efforts to scientifically explain the human experience of religion might yield in the future? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can watch this program as video and join our online chat at that time by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. It's an interesting question. How do we know that somebody's having a valid spiritual experience? What does that mean to be having a valid spiritual experience? I'm going to throw that back to you, Dr. Newberg, to start us off on that discussion. How do you know when someone's in your lab having their brain imaged that they are, in fact, having something that would be termed a spiritual experience?
Well, that is a great question. It gets down to phenomenology and what the person tells us about the experience. And it really raises a conundrum from a scientific perspective, because we can't tap somebody on the shoulder and then ask them if they've achieved nirvana yet, because that would completely ruin the experience for them. So to some degree, we rely on what people report to us and how they describe it. It's possible that we could look at other physiological parameters to see what kinds of states they seem to be getting into. But ultimately, it does come down a lot to what the person subjectively describes as their experience, the different elements of it, and to some degree we have to trust people in what they're describing to us. But even then, we're never completely sure if when they had the experience, we were able to capture that particular moment on the scan. So it's always a challenge, and we always have to be very cautious about any conclusions that we draw from a scan result, because we're not really sure if the scan is capturing that kind of very powerful spiritual experience that people can have. It's a real challenge.
Right. I want to throw it back to our panelists at the table here to respond and give their thoughts on the same thing.
Yeah, actually, excuse me, I think that I can tell you our research is looking at similar things but from a different method. So, for example, we're looking – rather than looking at normal individuals during states of meditation or prayer or speaking in tongues, another way to look at the relationship between brain functioning and spiritual experiences is to take people with brain dysfunction, find out people who have injured certain parts of their brain and see if there's changes in certain abilities. So, for example, that's pretty much how the practice of neuropsychology started. So that was before the advent of CAT scans or MRIs. And if somebody had hurt the left side of their brain and then they noticed that they had problems remembering what they hear, they could make a correlation between the left temporal lobe is associated with verbal memory. Another way to look at these spiritual experiences and brain functioning is to take people with brain injury, give them different measures of transcendence or spiritual experiences, and see what kind of correlations that you get. And basically, that's what we've done in our lab. So rather than look at people with normal functioning and putting in an MRI or SPECT scanner or PET scanner, we're basically taking them, giving them tests of different parts of the brain to indicate whether they're intact or not, and then correlating it with spiritual experiences.
And what are you finding through that research?
What we found, really surprisingly, is that people that injure the right parietal lobe of their brain reported being much more spiritual or spiritually transcendent than people that had injured other parts of the brain. And that really surprised us. It was somewhat of a fishing expedition when we did it. We got people with brain injury, did tests of many different parts of their brain, gave them a measure of spirituality, And then we found something that said that if you hurt your right parietal lobe, that's going to make you more spiritual. And that didn't make much sense to us. We thought if you're going to be more spiritual, you would probably have increased activity or integrity of that part of the brain. So we did some research. We found several of Dr. Newberg's studies, actually, that showed that, and Dr. Newberg, you can correct me if I'm wrong,
sure.
But basically showed that the Buddhist monks and the Franciscan nuns, different parts of the brain would light up and be active during their heightened states of spiritual experiences, but certain parts would become inactive, including the parietal lobes. And when we looked at other research, that was kind of a consistent finding. People who were more spiritual had decreased parietal lobe functioning, particularly right parietal lobe functioning. And then as a neuropsychologist, we looked at those people that we dealt with every single day that hurt their right parietal lobe. And it was really interesting. People who hurt their right parietal lobes are known to have, they're called disorders of the self, which means they have problems either perceiving the self or defining the self. They focus less on the self. So we're able to kind of make a connection that if your right parietal lobe is associated with defining and perceiving the self, and you hurt that part of the brain, you're not going to perceive or focus on the self as much, so you'll be able to focus on things beyond the self, which is the very definition of self-transcendence. And also, just one other thing to make clear, where Dr. Newberg has really looked at kind of heightened states of spiritual experience, we're looking more at kind of common experiences of spirituality, because not many people, I would say, walking the streets are going to say, you know what, I achieved nirvana today, or I was in communion with God today. And there are certain few that do it, and they're very fortunate. But different people probably have different levels of spirituality. Some people, you probably can just think about your family or friends, will feel very close to God or very close to nature. Other people won't. And that might be something that's genetically inherited. So we're kind of looking at degrees of, if I can talk about regular spiritual experience or regular spiritual transcendence, that's kind of what we're focused on.
And what might that look like? I mean, John Baker, maybe you could help us with that. What does a typical person feel as a normal level of spiritual transcendence?
Well, if I can go up to what he was,
go back
to what he was saying, could be that in your normal layperson's life, let's say the Christian faith, for example, it's one with which I'm the most familiar, there is a doctrine of predestination and being one of the elect, for example. It could very well be that people who have these either repressed or more active sections of the brain, either because they are born that way or they've developed that way as an adult, they are more inclined to lean in this religious direction, when others may not be so inclined. For them, they just don't get it. So over the centuries in larger populations, people have been defined either as in or out, and it could very well be something that's either developmental or genetic, and that sometimes maybe our holy texts might be talking about what is instead of what has been decreed. Just something to explore. Makes sense to me. It may not make sense to you.
I just like to say that in religious studies, the debate over what is and what is not religious experience has gone on for a long time. And there is certainly a subjective component there. And I think what's interesting is, as Dr. Newberg was pointing out before, is what happens to science when you're doing imaging studies in the laboratory and you're trying to determine whether something is indeed or you're classifying something as a religious experience, and then saying these are the scientific measurements of that religious experience. I think what's happened to some degree in religious studies, there's a lot of attention to neuroscience, and there's also a sense that what is and what is not a religious experience is somewhat determined by the holder of that experience, and that it has something to do with the specialness of that experience. But that being said, there do seem to be certain very interesting neurological correlates. So maybe what we're starting to do is to tease out a difference between spirituality and religion, that maybe spirituality is something that is inherent in all human beings, but the engagement of that is highly variable and both affected by things like experience and from the neurological side, neurological plasticity, This looks like where we might be going. We might be teasing out some different or nuancing out some interesting implications here.
So are you saying that spirituality is, pardon the pun here, sort of in the mind of the beholder in that sense, that different people might experience the same thing, but for some it would feel like a transcendent moment, and for others it would just feel like a piece of daily life?
The interpretation of the experience is what will determine whether it's a religious experience or not, and that is to the person themselves. They will make that determination to some degree. But perhaps the propensity to have a loss of sense of self, to lose oneself in the moment, is more of a panhuman trait that we might define as a form of spirituality in the most general sense. And Dr. Newberg has looked at this, I think, in a very convincing way in terms of building a model from the smallest experience of loss of self. You listen to music and you lose yourself in the song, and then you remember that it was your favorite song and it's over. What happened in those moments when you lost yourself?
Right. Andrew Newberg, right. why don't you pick up right there?
There's a lot of great comments. I mean, first of all, I'm very excited about the work looking at head injury patients and how that affects their spirituality, because it does tie in very nicely with the imaging work that we've been doing and the effects in the brain, particularly in the parietal lobe, as having something to do with these kinds of experiences. And I also definitely resonate with the idea of the diversity of these experiences and the range of these experiences. And by experiences, I mean, on one hand, we're talking about some of the stronger experiences that we try to study in our lab, but clearly there is the everyday experience of spirituality, of religiousness, and whether or not they are the same or different, and how we define them, both subjectively as well as perhaps physiologically, are some of the really exciting questions that I think this whole field of research can begin to engage in and try to get a better sense of how all of these different kinds of experiences affect us. We've actually been running an online survey of people's spiritual experiences, we've been calling it, and we've had a couple thousand people hit the website, and it's remarkable the diversity of the experiences. And I think, again, this is a way of utilizing science to try to understand the nature of what these experiences are all about. It doesn't necessarily have to even be the physiological underpinning of the experience, But it enables us to sort of systematically evaluate what these experiences are, how people define them, the cognitive content, the emotional content, the spiritual content of them, and then with always a bit of an eye of bringing that back to what's going on physiologically in the brain and in the body. So to me, all of this is a part of this, where this field has to go, and I think it really stands to teach us a tremendous amount about what spirituality is. And when you even say there's a difference between spirituality and religiousness, that's actually something I challenge my students with, and usually in the first class that I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, what's the difference between them? And it's every year I get different answers, so it's very interesting what people really do feel and think about these kinds of questions, and to be able to utilize a systematic approach that combines science with the spiritual, I think, to me, is going to be a very powerful way of looking at these questions going forward.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about your brain on religion. Joining me in the studio are Brick Johnson, a professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Daniel Cohen, a teaching assistant professor in the MU Department of Religious Studies, and John Baker, former senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Columbia. Also joining us by phone is Andrew Newberg, a neuroscientist and author of the book Principles of Neurotheology. For those of you in our audience, have you had what you would describe as a religious experience, a transcendent experience of some sort? If so, what was that about? What did you experience, and what did you think of that? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I'm going to come back to our table in just a second, but I want to ask Andrew Newberg one more question. What sort of response have you gotten to your books and your writing?
Well, at the risk of sounding naive, in general, it's been pretty positive. I think one of the goals that I've always had is I hope that I have a substantial respect for both the scientific side of things as well as the religious and spiritual side. So for me personally, this is not a way of it's not explaining away religious or spiritual experiences. It's a way of creating a new dialogue, a new perspective on these centuries, millennia old questions about who we are as human beings, how we are as spiritual beings, as biological beings. So in general, I think this information is useful regardless of what a person's belief system is or what tradition they come from, because it tells us something about how and why we are the way we are, and particularly with regard to our religious and spiritual beliefs. So whether somebody is a very devout religious individual or an atheist, I hope that this information becomes a value of use in helping us to understand how all of these different kinds of experiences affect us, where our belief systems come from, and hopefully tell us a little bit more just about us as human beings. So in general, I think people have recognized that and generally looked at it in fairly positive ways. And, you know, ultimately, we're still at the very beginning of things, so there's a long way to go, and our methods need to continue to develop and to advance. And so we're doing the best that we can, but we certainly recognize the limitations of what we've done so far, and there's certainly, like I said, a long way to go. And it's great to be with the company here, everybody looking at these kinds of questions, because this is how we begin to develop this whole field of work and really push all this information forward.
Brooke Johnson, would you agree that the response is generally positive to the scientific inquiry into religious experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of people that are very interested into how spiritual experiences might be tied to the brain. I'll say, however, it's always very interesting to present to different audiences.
Oh, yeah.
In some places, there is great risk to offend everybody. Mm-hmm. And if you speak to a scientific community or physicians, they'll basically say you shouldn't be doing this research. You're trying to objectify something that can't be objectified. And then you talk to people from religious communities, and they try and say you're trying to measure something that's immeasurable. Mm-hmm. And so you just try and say, well, that's generally – that can be true, but we're trying to find some trends, some basic things. And it's interesting, like Dr. Newberg said, I just taught a class, and in the very beginning, I asked students, do you think that spirituality may be partially genetically inherited or neurologically hardwired? And most of them say, oh, absolutely not. It's a gift from God. And it's like, well, can it be a gift from God, but still genetically inherited? And
sure.
And slowly over time, when you show them research, it begins to make sense, and people are kind of opening their minds. So I think over time, people are becoming much more accepting of it. I think 10, 15 years ago, it would have been very hard to do research like this in a medical setting, and now it's becoming common practice.
John Baker, you don't think this is undermining religion?
Well, it goes perhaps both ways in some instances, but like as Dr. Cohen said earlier, a plasticity, I think that Dr. Newberg speaks of this also in some of his books.
Sure.
And it's how we teach children in many ways when they begin their understanding of God, when those first concepts are placed in the brain. We have to be very careful with what we place there, I think, because if we give a child a first image of God as wrathful, vengeful, authoritarian, critical, judgmental, and if we keep that child in that kind of atmosphere – for their first few, you know, years of life and development, there's a very good chance that they're going to respect and admire that character of God and put some of those characters in their own lives. On the other hand, if that child, when very young, understands forgiveness and some of those kind of characteristics, and if God is that way, then we hope that as they're an adult and they live in civil society, that they will reflect in their own lives some of those same traits.
I have to break us off here because we're going to go into a break. I want to thank Andrew Newberg for joining us today on Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We're going to say goodbye to Dr. Newberg. And for everyone else, we're going to stay at the table here and continue this conversation after the break. This is Intersection on KBIA. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the connections between religious experience and the human brain. Joining me in the studio are Brick Johnston, a professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Daniel Cohen, a teaching assistant professor in the MU Department of Religious Studies, and John Baker, the former senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Columbia. For those of you in our audience, do you think spiritual things like meditation or praying regularly has an impact on your life? If you do these things and you've seen some impact, share that experience with us. Let us know how that has gone. We hope you'll give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Just before the break, we were talking about the idea of plasticity in the brain, the idea that religious experience might shape what happens within the brain. And I wonder if, Brick Johnston, you might talk a little bit about that and how that fits in with where the research stands these days.
I would love to, but in all honesty, I think Dr. Cohen is much better able to...
Fantastic. Dr. Cohen, then, please.
Okay. There's certainly become a lot more interest in positive psychology and in positive aspects of behavior in the field of psychology in the last 20 or so years. So there's a significant change there, and we now can explore things and are exploring things like virtues and altruism, compassion, empathy, for example, and how they are perhaps constructed, and perhaps they have certain types of neurological components as well as other aspects of how they occur ritually, religiously, et cetera. This is a very interesting area because it shows us that there are purposeful, for example, ritual practices that can be engaged in that cause changes in behavior, positive changes in behavior. So when meditators meditate, for example, and be it Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, whatever form of meditation, there can be over time a change in how the brain perceives the self, the brain perceives the world around the self, and how people respond and behave toward other individuals and society at large. And these can be very positive directions for behavior to move. So this may be showing us that there are ways that we can deal with human situations and human problems, perhaps, and understanding how some of these ritual techniques and some of these belief structures and systems help us become fuller people, fuller human beings, happier and more fulfilled in our lives.
And are there examples or one maybe that one of you can cite in terms of what that would look like? Sort of what might somebody do and what that might do to their lives in terms of the way that they go about this? John Baker, maybe you've seen an experience of this?
I've had people that have had fundamental personality changes when they've been embraced by the faith that was in their faith community that they had been distant from before, but when they firmly embraced it. One was a couple who were, and this sounds so stereotypical, but they were hardcore drinkers. They were hardcore vocal abusers of one another and other members of their families. And they had this encounter with God's Spirit in a church in Kentucky. And it is almost as if a light switch was flicked. They had no desire to drink again. Their language changed. Their desire to give to others instead of just focus on their self. It was this dramatic change in both of their lives, a husband and wife team. So not only were they aligned emotionally and mentally with some similar value structures, but they had a very similar religious experience in this one church. And for them, everything became different. It's very much like some of those New Testament statements about all things becoming new. For this couple, it happened that way. It was a dramatic turn of life for them, more than anyone I've ever seen before.
And how might science attempt to explain that? I mean, that's not necessarily a cognitive behavioral change that over time would reroute neural pathways necessarily, if it's sort of an instant they've seen the light, right?
I think that's what I was talking about before. That's, I don't know if you'd categorize it as a mystical experience, but a lot of people will have an experience that changes their life drastically. That is one way that you can look at these things, or you can look at people who have many years of practice that help them to achieve spiritual states much easier. So, for example, the Buddhist monks that Dr. Newberg will investigate, they've probably been practicing for years, and it's a lot easier for them to achieve transcendent states than maybe any of us. I wanted to go back to a point that Dr. Cohen made when you're talking about like neuroplasticity, which I think is really interesting. This goes back to basic neuropsychology. If I show you a picture of yourself, your right parietal lobe becomes very active. If I show you a picture of somebody else, your left parietal lobe will become very active. So it's the right parietal lobe is focused on yourself, left parietal lobe is focused on others. Well, in a Western culture that's very me-focused, I mean, if you just look all around us, Canada, United States, Great Britain, we're very me-focused. You look at many different Eastern cultures, it's kind of like the idea is to get rid of the self. So there's like, I don't know how you call it, an anti-me focus. But they've done some neurological studies that show that these Eastern Asian religions have different neural processing of the self, which is probably related to cultural practices. So you can basically train your brain to process information just through different spiritual or religious rituals or practices.
And is there any indication that some people are naturally predisposed to one side or the other?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where it's kind of like I think our research is going. And what we wanted to do is basically like Dr. Cohen was saying, for a lot of people you say, what's religious and what's spiritual? And there is no difference. And we said we have to basically distinguish between the two. And we've done some studies that show that religion is pretty much like behavioral practices. You know, I go to church, I pray, I do this, I believe this because I've been taught this. Spiritual experiences are more like neurologically based, and to be real simple, they're like a feeling of an emotional connection with God or the universe. So that is more brain-based, where the religious is more cultural-based. What we figured we needed to do then is rather than just look at spirituality as a big global construct, we needed to look at specific aspects of spirituality. So for example, I could say, let's talk about cognitive abilities. You know, do you have a cognitive ability? You'll say, yes, I have many. Memory, attention, language, visual, spatial skills. We think it's the same with spirituality. Rather than say we're going to investigate the spirituality of the brain, there's different constructs. And the one that we focused on most is self-transcendence. So we focused on one part of the brain related to defining the self. And then basically if you decrease that, you will experience a decreased focus on the self, which is the very, like I said before, the very definition of self-transcendence.
But the, you know, the interpretation of that within different religious systems can be very different. For example, a Buddhist may be engaging in different types of meditation practices in order to lose what is seen as a false self or a false sense of self, whereas you know, a monastic Christian nun may be engaging in a similar type of meditative practice, but for the purpose of connecting with God and becoming one with God. Both experiences are described by the practitioners themselves as a loss of sense of self. But the actual explanation of what's happening in the interpretation, the outer framework, is quite different, and each receptive to its own religious background.
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting, Dr. Newberg's work with the monks and the nuns, their brain patterns were basically very similar, but their interpretations were very different. Mm-hmm. So that shows you that the experience is the same, the interpretation is different. I got a little off track, which I sometimes do.
No, this is fascinating. This is all part of what we want to. I was hoping we'd get to talk about.
Okay,
today.
Good. I get off track a lot, so just pull me back. You're talking about the genetic. Are people predisposed to being spiritual? And the answer is yes. And there is a book by Dean Hamer, and it's called The God Gene. And basically in that book, he looks at all these twin studies. And if you look, twin studies are conducted to determine how much of a trait is inheritable versus how much is learned. So, for example, if you two are identical twins, and John and I were fraternal twins, the concordance rate between a certain ability or trait would be higher for you than it would be for us. So you guys would probably be of the same height, of the same weight, of the same eye color, more so than us. Same to a degree about personality traits or intelligence, things like that. Well, these twin studies, real large ones from like Australia and some other countries, show that the concordance rate of being spiritual, which they defined as a feeling of closeness to the universe, was much higher in identical twins than fraternal twins. And it didn't matter if they were raised together or raised apart. So that suggests that people do have a genetic predisposition to being spiritual or feeling close to nature. It's no different than a personality trait. And an analogy that I use a lot is if you think about language, we're all genetically predisposed to speak language. It's neurologically hardwired in the left hemisphere, but the way it's expressed is based on your culture. If you're born in the United States, you speak English. If you're born in France, you speak French. Same with spirituality. All of us are predisposed to be somewhat spiritual, more or less. It's neurologically hardwired in some parts of the brain. For us, we're focused on the right parietal lobe. And the way that it is experienced, whether it's nirvana or connection with God, is based on your culture and kind of what you're taught.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Ruth from Columbia is with us. Ruth, are you there?
I am.
Great. Thank you for joining the program and for calling in today.
Sure, no problem.
Do you have a question for our panelists or a story to share?
I think Dr. Johnstone just kind of answered it. I was interested in talking about kind of the other end of things, whether or not we are shaped to be spiritual, or we are inherently shaped to be spiritual, or to seek transcendence, or however you want to put that. I mean, I recently read a study about rats being empathic, and what does this mean for us and for our – I mean, is this a developmental thing, or what's going on here? And again, I appreciate Dr. Johnstone's response to the earlier discussion, and thanks.
Okay, thank you for calling in, and we'll go ahead and put the question to the panelists here.
I can give a quick answer. excuse me. It seems that a lot of lines of evidence are pointing to the fact that, as Dr. Newberg said before, one component of our humanity is that we are spiritual beings. And what the various types of brain research and neuroscience research and cognitive neuroscience may be showing us is that there are ways to connect to parts of ourselves that we're not either not aware of or not fully able to explore. And we see this in brain injury population potentially. We see it with religious practices. We see it with research involving psychoactive substances, that perhaps what's going on is that the brain is a doorway and that we're learning or better being able to use that doorway to explore information about the universe and about life that is difficult to get access to. One sort of last thing I would say there is that there's a lot of interesting research in physics, in cosmology, in astronomy that are opening up whole new ideas about our physical existence. And these things may have some interesting relationships with what we're experiencing as spiritual beings. In other words, things seem to be much more complex and keep becoming more complex as we understand them better and better. That includes the brain and the world around us.
John Baker, I'm curious about your response to what Dr. Johnson said in terms of that difference between spirituality and religion and the connection or lack of connection in some cases between those two things.
Mm-hmm. Religion can be where one becomes very obedient to what one is supposed to do. And you can be perfect in all of those ways. And it has some kind of an external, you know, you can actually measure it, whether you're being religious. But I think spirituality, as they both said here, and Dr. Newberg also, it's really not all that measurable, easily at least, because of that fine line. What happens inside a person is kind of inside that person. And it's hard to say what is a baseline amongst all people about what a spiritual experience is or isn't. You can kind of measure the religious, but you can't really measure the spiritual. I went to church Sunday, had a wonderful time. It was a Christmas-focused service. It was a semi-rural congregation. We're not members there. We just went. And we sat there. We felt welcome. It was a very warm, engaging room. Again, it was a Christmas season-focused service. adult choir, children active, a lot of familiarity with the songs, but they were done differently. But we really felt good. We felt at home. We felt like we were reaching out to something bigger than we were at this holiday season. We were seeking this embrace of love and forgiveness that the Christian story has at this time of year, and, you know, God's love being made manifest. We were reaching for that, and we felt that in church Sunday. It's a very important feeling for us, my wife and I. That was a spiritual experience. It wasn't religious so much as it was spiritual. Do you understand the difference?
Yeah, I think that agrees with what we're trying to, mm-hmm. to look at, in that we have a lot of people that when we do our research, they say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Mm-hmm. And then we have other people say, yeah, I know somebody who's real religious, but they're not very spiritual. So that goes back to, if you're an atheist, you can be spiritual and feel connected to the universe or nature or whatever, and that's what we're focused on. So you might be a Buddhist, I might be a Christian, you might be Jewish, you might be an atheist, but we'll all be equally spiritual, but just in different ways.
And some of the neural pathways, I think, that can be created or enriched, they don't have to have a religious label attached to them. They can happen mm-hmm. through just kind of a general form of meditation. You know, it can help with memory. It can help with just some of the quickness of the mind's processes for senior adults, for example. And that can happen just through these meditative type things. But if you then think about who's in our churches a lot, it's older adults. It could be that they don't even know that they're there because they're getting all of this help with their mental health and well-being and community involvement. It's good for them.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the connections between religious experience and the human brain. Joining me in the studio are Brick Johnston, a professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Daniel Cohen, a teaching assistant professor in the MU Department of Religious Studies, and John Baker, former senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Columbia. For those of you in our audience, if you have a story about your own religious experiences to share, we'd love to hear them. Feel free to give us a call. Our number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or you can go online and join our online chat by following the link at kbia.org. It's interesting that discussion of atheism and spirituality, because that's not something that we talk about a lot. Many denominations of various religions sort of say, we've got the lock on your spiritual future, and if you don't sort of follow our way of getting to spirituality, you may or may not actually be at one with God, or whatever way they phrase that. Brick Johnston, I wonder if you could talk a little more about that separating of those two things out, because that seems fairly new under a lot of religious discussion.
Oh, absolutely. I think we get in a lot of trouble when we use the terms religious and spiritual, because they're used interchangeably. And spiritual almost means otherworldly. And it's like Carl Sagan had said, I think he was an atheist, but he's like, all you got to do is look out in the sky. You know the wonders of nature and the universe, and there's something powerful and wonderful out there. Sorry, your question.
Just in terms of that separation. Of that and the connection of spiritual with things like atheists.
Yeah, sure. I would rather than use the term spiritual, I think you can almost talk about it in terms of like emotional connection with other things. So whether you're an atheist, you might feel really connected to the universe. And people want to get out in the mountains, they want to climb, they want to feel close to nature, they want to feel close to the mountains, they want to feel close to the sky. They are really connected to nature. Other people have that same emotional connection, but they'll have it to God or Yahweh, or, you know, Dr. Cohen is an expert in Hinduism, or multiple gods within Hinduism. So it doesn't, I think in our line of research, it's not so important what you're connected to. It's just that connection with something. And it's a very deep connection. It's not just like, yeah, I'm your friend. You know, if you think about it, there's various degrees. You'll have emotional connection to a spouse, which will be very deep. Emotional connection with friends, who won't be as deep. And then there's the ultimate connection, which will be to an ultimate being or God or nirvana. So that's probably how I would differentiate those.
Dr. Cohen, your thoughts on that?
Well, there are cultural dimensions to this as well. So I'm not going to answer your question directly, except to give an example.
That'd quickly. Be great.
One of my colleagues studies illness in the context of Japan, and in the context of Zen Buddhism. And Alzheimer's in Japan has a very different cultural coding than what we see here in the U.S. For a number of people in Japan, if one of their elderly relatives is showing increasing signs of Alzheimer's disease, that is also seen as a loss of sense of self, which is a very positive thing from a Zen Buddhist context. But obviously in the U.S., the same type of symptomatology would be seen in a very negative light as someone is losing their memory, their experiences of who they are. So these things are coded in other ways besides sort of the objective sense that we think about them in.
So how do you research that then? I mean, if different cultures view that differently, I mean, if in Japan Alzheimer's is viewed as a increase in spirituality, I mean, more of a connection to the universe, less of a...
Well, you have to understand it within the full system that it's existing in. So, for example, your particular social identity is not who you are ultimately in that context. So the fact that you can't hold on to that may not be as significant or may even represent a spiritual development, a positive spiritual development, albeit brought about by something that is a cognitive impairment.
Go
ahead.
Here's another example. A lot of people have read the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. Mm-hmm. And it was about a Hmong family that lived in Los Angeles, I believe, and they had a child with a seizure disorder.
Yeah.
And in their culture, that was kind of almost a spiritual event where basically God would be communing with whoever was having the seizure. And in the United States, seizure is a neurological abnormality. We treat it with medication if we want to stop it. And it led to a lot of cultural fighting between the culture, the family, and the medical system, and I think they both learned from each other. So that would be another example.
And how would that play into the research that you all are doing then? That is a good example of two completely different belief systems going at something that has what we would consider a scientific component, the medical establishment in this country, and the way that spirituality is used to counter ills in that other Hmong tradition.
We've already done some of it. We've done one study that looked at five different faith traditions to see if they differ in terms of religiosity or spirituality and how it relates to health. So we are looking at different faith traditions. We've just put out a proposal to look at different types of prayer to see how they are manifest in the brain, whether it's meditation or if it's like a Christian-centered prayer. Then we're going to do structured interviews. We'll take somebody with an expertise like Dr. Cohen and say, all right, this was your experience, but tell me about your culture. How is it that your culture is helping you interpret this?
Right. And is it possible that brain damage would lead somebody to become more religious, that it would, you know, perhaps the brain would get damaged in some way that you would have the opposite kind of ailment on your hands there, where somebody became hyper-religious as a result of a brain injury?
Yeah, and I want to be real careful with that because that's one of the problems we get into is people will say, there's just three people sitting at a table saying that brain damage leads to religiosity. And we're not saying that at all.
Right.
If a certain part of your brain becomes less active, either through practice like meditation or prayer, or less active through injury, that might make you more spiritual. There's another part of the brain, the left temporal lobe. If you have a seizure in that part of the brain, that means there's going to be electrical activity in that part of the brain. People become hyper-religious. And that suggests that that part of the brain might control another spiritual ability, that if you overactivate it, you're going to experience it more. So like a lot of people who have left temporal lobe epilepsy or schizophrenia who have overactive left temporal lobes, they'll report religious delusions where they think that they are hearing God or they can talk to God or Satan is behind them and that's always following them. So there are certain types of disorder that lead to truly abnormal religious experiences.
But you would say that it's not possible that people who, you know, historically have gone into the record books as being hyper-religious, not in a bad way in our theology, but some of the prophets or other religious figures, I mean, is it possible that they had something going on in their brain differently that caused them to
yes.
be what they are?
That's, I mean, the conversion of Paul.
Pretty dramatic story.
That's a dramatic story. He's on a horse. He fell off. Some people thought he might. Some people now look back and say it's possible he had a seizure. Same with Joan of Arc. Other people have been in different experiments with drugs, and they've had these intense religious experiences that have dramatically changed their lives. And that's not saying that drugs make you religious or a seizure will make you religious, but maybe it will make you more susceptible to be open to religious or spiritual experiences.
John Baker, you agree with that?
Well, yes, I do. And I have other questions that relate to that as well. We are learning that certain portions of the brain carry with them certain definitions or personalities of God along with them. Amygdala, would that be the correct pronunciation of central, one of our ancient parts of our brain development?
The amygdala.
Excuse me. See, I need your help.
That's all right.
But that is some of the locations for some of the more authoritarian, critical, judgmental ideas about God's personality as I read the literature a little bit, versus frontal lobe development, which is more benevolent, forgiving, mystical, if you please. So can we, with the plasticity of the brain idea in mind, can we work to learn how to slow down certain portions of our brain or make harder working other areas of our brain so that we can have perhaps more balanced religious expression, whatever our religious interest might be? Perhaps that's a way to look at it.
But isn't that sort of, I mean, isn't there a view that could say, but God made me this way with my overactive amygdala?
But if you can meditate and if you can speed this up or slow this down, if you're on a destructive pattern, either for yourself, others, or socially, can we work on that?
Sure. I would say think of it the same as a musical ability. If you basically practice music for years and years and years, your brain is kind of wired in a certain way that you will be, it'll be very easy for you to be musical. If you engage in meditation or prayer every day and you're in a monastery, it makes it easier for your mind to kind of get into that state of mind and reach that state. So it's basically, it's practice makes perfect with neurological functioning too. A real quick anecdote, one of my more interesting stories, the BBC did a program on what they call like God on the Brain or something like that. There was a man in his mid-40s in London who developed left temporal lobe epilepsy, but he was an atheist. And he started to experience religious delusions. Hmm. And their question was, well, if you're an atheist and all of a sudden you experience religious delusions, what kind of religious delusions do you experience? What do you think he did?
And that was because a piece of his brain got injured that brought that about?
Yeah, that suggests that that part of the brain might be related to the expression of different religious archetypes. He had those delusions in terms of Christian experiences. And the thoughts were, although he's an atheist, that I don't believe in God, it's he grew up in a Christian culture. And so when he was having this firing of these religious archetypes or cultural archetypes, he interpreted them based on what he had lived for all those different years. So
fascinating.
It is really fascinating.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are running out of time here. I think that's about where we're going to have to stop. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Brick Johnston, professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Daniel Cohen, teaching assistant professor in the MU Department of Religious Studies, and John Baker, former senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Columbia. Also on the phone, we had Andrew Nürburg, neuroscientist and author of the book Principles of Neurotheology. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Karen Clifford. Our audio producer is Pat Akers. Executive producers are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.